Okay, so let's start with electronics part B lectures. And from the same textbook that we used for part A, the story is systems approach. Now the first chapter for this course is chapter 11, which gives a kind of a general description of electronic systems and discusses systems in general. So this is quite general discussion overall, so no equations or anything like that in this chapter. So first, so as you probably are aware that we are surrounded by electronic systems. So we have computers, cell phones, mobile telecommunication systems all over the place, Wi-Fi, satellites, cars are more or less electronic systems nowadays. So they are everywhere. And it is basically the reason why those are used is that they are effective. So you can do the many things with electronics and electronic systems, and you just interface, depending on what you want to do, then you interface that system to these actuators or sensors that we discussed in part A, so that basically the processing of data can be done electronically, and then the interface to or from the kind of the real world, so to speak, is then done by these sensors and actuators. And so if you think about systems, then in the end, the only few are purely electronic. If you think, depending on how we will talk about the kind of the limitation of the boundary of the system, so how you set the system. So if you think about computer, for example, you would think that it's purely electronic, but in the end, you have a keyboard, you have a mouse, you have a display, and especially keyboard and mouse, they are not fully electronic because there you have to press the keys, so there are some mechanics involved. So it is, and cars, for example, there are many things that are not electronic, but they electronics are connected to those mechanic and other types of systems. So it can be very versatile and interdisciplinary things that is needed for these kind of systems. It depends on how you define a system. So what is your system, or is it the subsystem of within a bigger system? So, but in the end, you need various kinds of engineering skills and techniques when dealing with systems. In this course, we don't go into very very broad aspects of systems, but in this chapter, we at least give a glimpse of what systems can be or what you can consider as a system and how to deal with them. So, systems approach to engineering. So, as I already mentioned, these kind of examples of systems, a system can be very complex, and it might take or need very different approaches in order to analyze, and design. So if we consider a kind of a conventional approach, which is called a systematic approach, is that you just take subsystems of a bigger system. You divide it in parts, and you go from top to down, top to bottom, or top down approach, and you just analyze and design one system or subsystem at a time, and then you sum them up, and the whole system is sum of its parts and nothing else. But then if you think systems in a more generic or more broader spectrum, that here's just one example, that for a car, for example, that if you just divide the seats and the steering wheel, the motor, the radio, and so on, if you just sum them, if you just take them individually and design them as good as you can, and then you put them together, you might not have a good car, so that it's good for the user or the driver, so it feels good. So you have to design it so that you take everything into account the same time when you are doing the design, not only looking at the certain part, and don't consider all the rest. So it's not only fully electronic or fully mechanical or fully some other artistic engineering that you need to take into account. So you have to have a balance between all the parts, and they have, during the process, everything has to be kind of considered at once. So for that, there are these kind of a systemic approach that looks at the characteristics of the whole system or the complete system, not only individual parts within that system. But still, that systemic approach is kind of not taking into account necessarily the like in the car, the feel of the system, or the driving of the car. So then this kind of so-called systems approach, which is more like a holistic approach of engineering, that combines the systematic and systemic elements. So this is kind of a, as said, it takes into account various aspects of design and engineering. So it's not only that you have a good team of mechanical engineers, or good group of electrical engineers who do perfect electrical engineering design, but then they design something that is more than just electrical engineering, or it's not only electronic system. It like you think that, like, good example is the Apple products, like iPhone and iPads and those things. They need a very robust and good electronic engineering skills. But there is also other people who need to be involved, so that they're kind of the user experience is good. So it doesn't matter if the computer inside is perfect, but if it's really bad to use, and it doesn't look good, then people don't use it. So you need some other people than just electronic engineers to in that sense. Of course, electrical engineers can be good at thinking of those as well. It doesn't, I don't mean that, but still, you need to know more than just plain electronics on doing those kind of systems. But anyhow, so that is just kind of giving you ideas that it's good to have a broader view when you do things, and you have to take into account many aspects when designing things and being part of this kind of a design team. Okay, then let's define a little bit. Let's go. So, in a sense, this course is more, we are still in this conventional approach. So this, even though the textbook is named Systems Approach, we still consider more like a systematic approach to the things. So we will be dealing with those subsystems and smaller parts. So we are not trying to develop or trying to look at broader systems in this systems meaning of systems approach as it is defined in the previous slide. Okay, so the system is defined. So we can take any closed volume or closed entity which have some inputs and outputs that we know. So anything can be considered as a system. So it doesn't have to be a concrete thing. So it can be a in if you think about general case, it can be something like a traffic in a some crossroad, for example. So we know how many cars is going in, we know how many cars is coming out, we know what is the time, so traffic hours, so when there is more cars. So we can consider that as a system, and we can then deal with that as a system and do design on the traffic lights, what is the timing of the traffic lights, and so on. And we can kind of we can affect the input and that, or the throughput. So how fast, so if there is certain time of the day, we need to have the traffic lights acting a certain way in order to get fluent traffic. And then on some other time of the day, it doesn't matter how the traffic lights, they can be turned off, for example. It doesn't matter, it still works. So these kind of things that it we don't a system can be very broadly defined. So here are a few other examples. So an engine management system in a car or any other motor or cars in general, transportation system, like I told you, transportation system could be a bus line or bus lines within a city. So that is a system we can affect with different ways to that ecosystem, which is of course a much broader scale. But we can then within an ecosystem we can consider some small area. For example, there are different species living in a forest in a certain area. We can see how that works and analyze, and we can consider that as a system. And it of course depends on what we define as input and outputs. So all these systems basically can be reduced to a box. So we have inputs going in and outputs coming out, and within that system we have some activities happening depending on what is the system. So in electronics there are currents and voltages, current and voltage signals going out in different components, and they do their stuff and do some calculations or whatever we have programmed or designed within that system. and it is kind of predetermined that if we put an input of some sort, we have an explicit output on the other side. So it kind of the transfer characteristics are known. Of course, there are some in these more complex systems like ecosystem or traffic or transportation. It's not always it's more like probabilities that if we have an input of some sort, there's a certain higher probability for some output to occur, because there are always some inaccuracies and uncertainties in real life, so which is kind of a noise within that system. So there are some errors occurring naturally, which we cannot affect by ourselves, or we can only take into account in the design how much those affect the outputs in the end. As I said, it depends on how you define a system, so or system boundary. So for example, this simple example of a microphone, amplifier, and a speaker, then we can define a system so that we have an input of sound and the output is sound. So your voice that goes into the microphone is the input, and the sound that comes out amplified at the speaker from the speaker is the output. So this is one way of defining the system or the system boundary. But then if we change, we can as well change the boundary. And now when we do this way, that the input to our system in that we are dealing with is electrical, that is taken from the microphone, and the output is electrical, which is taken from the audio amplifier that goes to the speaker. Now we are kind of more we are narrowing the boundary, so that now we are more or less all electronic, whereas the previous was not fully electronic system. So these kind of choices can be made, and depending on what you now we this the system that is now defined here, and if we would start doing things with this audio amplifier on its own, we don't necessarily know. We might have some limitations depending on what type of microphones we can use. So it might, so we would design an audio amplifier, and that design might make some limitations of what kind of microphone we can use or what kind of speaker we can use or should use. So then that we need to have some information about those external parts of the system if we want to have it working properly. And as I said, the components that interact with the outside world are called sensors and actuators, which we talked in the previous course, so part A. So microphone is a sensor and the loudspeaker is an actuator in this previous example. And physical quantities and electrical signals. So if you think about the surrounding world and the physical properties and quantities that we have around ourselves, temperature, pressure, humidity, etc. They are not electronic, obviously. but we would like to have them as electronic because it, then we can store the data electronically, which is kind of much easier than putting it on the paper from a meter that is some analog meter or something. And physical quantities, they can be continuous or discrete. So if we think about, so those are the two types of quantities that we can have, or modes, so to speak. So continuous quantities, they change smoothly, and they, basically you can have an infinite number of values between maximum and minimum of what you have in the range of so temperature, for example, in nature, there is no digits. So basically the temperature of air outside, it can vary, and it can vary infinite with infinite steps, number of steps. So there is no smaller steps that the temperature can change. There's it only when you measure, you define the minimum step by the resolution of your meter that you use. And discrete quantities, they changed abruptly from one value to another. So if you think about like rough division between continuous and discrete, you can say that the kind of the real world or natural quantities are continuous: temperature, humidity, amount of light, and so on. They are continuous. And roughly, the man-made quantities are usually discrete to a certain extent, depending on what we, there are some continuous man-made quantities as well, but usually, because we are dealing with digital things which are discrete by default. And so, as said, many of the physical quantities, we would like to transfer them to electrical signals. And electrical signals, they can be continuous or discrete as well. So if you think about continuous signals in electronics, they are called as analog signals. So here we have a voltage signal over time that changes more or less randomly, but this kind of analog and continuous voltage signal, that there is no steps here, so it just changes, and it can have like infinite number of steps within. So how close you zoom, there's never a step, so it's always kind of continuous. But of course, it depends on how you measured this, really. So it's more like a philosophical question rather than electronics problem. And the discrete signals, they are often described as digital. And moreover, digital signals, in the end, they are mostly binary signals. So you have two stages, 0 and 1. Then, of course, you can build a more levels by adding more bits. So adding more places for zeros and ones, you can build digital signals that have the resolution is more than just two states. And then about the systems, and so basically we can, in the previous slide, we had these inputs and outputs. So inputs going into a box and outputs coming out from the box. But then when we look into that box, we can then subdivide it into smaller boxes and build these so-called block diagrams. So we can have, so, and each block diagram is kind of a system on its own. So here is a simplified block diagram for a control and processing of a motor of a car. So there are number of sensors, pressure, temperature, speed of a flywheel, position, throttle valve, and so on, which are read into this kind of a engine control unit that makes decisions based on the inputs from the sensors. It has a power supply that takes energy, gives energy to it, and then it gives information about from these sensors that how this coil should what the coil should do, and it will give the distributor a signal that then flares up the spark plugs. So this is just one small sub system, very simplified, what the car has inside. There are plenty of other stuff happening at the same time, but this is kind of what one way of controlling the spark plugs in a car. So now we have kind of a information about what are the inputs, what are the outputs, and how it should work, and then we can start working on this ECU, for example, how to make it more efficient, and so on. And this ECU itself, we could then break this into parts, and there are plenty of other like subsystems within that we can go into and zoom in and check out how it works. So in electrical system, the flow of energy or the current, it requires a circuit, as we spoke, as we discussed in the previous part of the course. So for example, here we have one input, one output. Similarly, what we had, the microphone and the loudspeaker. And what we call now the sensor that is giving the input to this system, we call that a source, and the actuator that is at the output of this system, that we call a load. So we have a source and load, and usually it's given so that the source is on the left side of the system and the load is on the right side of the system. So it's just the kind of gives you the flow of information or flow of the signal, but it's not, it's just how it's typically considered, but it's not mandatory to have it. It can go from top to bottom or wherever direction. And then if we have within the system, we have subsystems, then each subsystem can act as a load and source. So for example, here we have three subsystems. So subsystem A is a load for the source, for the sensor source, and it is a source for the subsystem B, which is a load then for subsystem A. And then we have a chain of subsystems, and at the end we have the subsystem C is sourcing the load, which is the actuator at the end. So we can consider it that the flow of signal this way. So this was a brief introductory or discussion about systems in general. So engineering is nowadays especially interdisciplinary. So it's no longer just one type of thing that you need to master. So you need to take into account many things. So this systems approach need to be taken in many times. And then the systems in general, they are considered or defined by the inputs and the outputs and the relationship between those two. And the systems interact the world with sensors and actuators that we already considered earlier. The physical quantities can be continuous or discrete, depending on what we are talking about. And from the electronics point of view, we always have discrete signals because we are bound to the binary system that we have. So in the end, we have zeros and ones in the computers and the electronic systems that we use. Well, we can have an analog amplifier, which is then there's a continuous, let's say, audio signal going out in, and there's a continuous audio signal out. So that is not necessarily a discrete. But if there is any digital signal processing inside that system, then the output will have a discrete levels. It might not be something that you see immediately or hear, but it is there. If we have at any point within the system, if we have transferred the analog signal into a digital, then we will have discrete signal at the end. And one thing that we now next will consider is this block diagram. So complex systems, it is easier to understand and follow the signals and the flow of signals by using a block diagram. So basically, anything can be turned into a block diagram. Like we discussed these systems earlier, like ecosystem, we can build a ecosystem using block diagrams. So the inputs are so if you consider a population of mice within a certain area, we can have inputs to that block diagram. The output is a number of mice. The input is the time of the year, temperature, number of predators, certain types of predators within that area, and so on. But still, we can build that as a block diagram. So it makes our kind of the consideration a little bit easier. Okay, now we go to this how to control the system, and then we talk about feedback, which is essential. We already had that in part A. We had the feedback in the operational amplifier circuits, which kind of enabled control on the amplification of the total amplifier. This will be the kind of the continuation from there. So the outline, we will talk about open loop, closed loop systems, automatic control systems, then feedback systems, about negative feedback, what is negative. We will talk about positive feedback in the in other chapter of the course. And so the basic idea is that control is the key. So any system, we would need to have some sort of control over the behavior of the system. So Either it's kind of predefined so that it set once and then kind of the system behaves how it behaves and you never touch it again. Then we can have automatic, so we set certain rules to it. And depending on what are the inputs and how the outputs are behaving, it might kind of steer itself or control itself, so that it won't go it won't give too high values or too low values, or it doesn't start oscillating or something like that. So, and then we are talking about automatic control, which we will deal in a minute. So there are always some sort of regulation or command involved. And many times that we have a goal, we want to determine a value or state or some physical quantity and try to maintain that value despite the kind of the variations in the system or variation in the environment. For example, a heater, I think we have a few examples here. We will come into those in a minute. So if you consider open loop and closed loop system, so simple control is usually open loop. So that is the simplest case. So we have a certain goal to achieve. Then we have a system that is open, that we have just a forward path, and then we have the output. And the user is trying it has in mind that, okay, I want to have a certain thing happening. Let's say we want to have a certain temperature in our room. And then we have a heater, which is our system, that gives the output for the room temperature. And we set a certain parameters for the heater, and we hope that it will get to that temperature that is our goal. But then if we for that temperature, for example, the heater, that if the environment changes, so first we have a cold day, and we put the heater on and it heats up and we get comfortable temperature in our room. But then the outside temperature goes up, then the heater is still heating and we get too hot inside. Then we need to go and set another parameter and then hope that and wait until the output is what we want. So this is kind of an open loop system that the user needs to be active, and it's not really convenient. More convenient is that there is a closed loop system that has the user sets a goal, and then we have a system that reads that goal inside and then makes the decision that, okay, let's heat the heater, have an output, then take that output and compare that to the goal that was set. And if the difference is too high, we still heat and heat until the comparator says that, okay, now it's so the temperature is okay. Then we stop heating and the output is now okay. Then it starts to cool down, and then this comparator senses that, okay, now we are missing the goal, we need to heat again, and it starts heating and get back to the real temperature. The user doesn't need to do anything. It just has set the goal in the thermostat, and it takes care of this system takes care of the setting the temperature in the room. So this is a closed loop. We have this feedback here. So here's the example. So we, like I said, thermostat, set it, heater is heating when the temperature is too low, and temperature sensor is sensing the output temperature and checks whether we still need to heat up or not. Cruise controlling car is basically the same kind of idea. The user, we set the speed that we want to travel. Then the car is sensing the speed of the car. And if we are going too slow, then the throttle actuator will activate and there is more speed for the car and until we are at the speed that is set. Sometimes, so this works. One thing to note is that both of these, depending on how this is done and what is the forward path system, whether you only have, for example, in the car, if you are only controlling the throttle, so the rightmost pedal, so to speak, or are you also is the system also controlling the brake? Because if you are going downhill and you're going too high velocity or too high speed, then this speed sensor will tell, okay, we are going too high, and of course you don't put more gas in the car or you don't pull the throttle at that point. But you, whether maybe in the more sophisticated cars, it kind of brakes a little so that it doesn't go over speed. The same goes with the heater. So this is even, so there's no way that the heater, well, wrong to say, there are some heaters that they can also cool. So for example, the air conditioning units that you can heat and cool. So you can put it in automatic mode, and if the room gets too hot, then you have set, let's say you have put 20 centigrade for your goal, and then you measure the temperature outside goes, so there's a really hot day, then your temperature sensor says that, okay, there's now 22 degrees centigrade. Then your AC unit starts to cool down and cools down until we get 20 degrees. So it can go both ways. It doesn't always heat, depending on what is your system. In this kind of a old school heater, it's only one way. So if it gets too hot, it will just stop. And the thermostat is inactive, but it cannot affect obviously the heat or the cooling down of the room. Basically, as said, any natural thing can be considered as a system. This the same goes with the human body. So if you think about how human body works, we can break that into and consider that as a system as well, and break it into parts and consider one part at a time. Of course, it doesn't work if we consider a human body as a systematic way. So if we just consider each part individually, and then we think that it would work that if we have fully functional parts, different parts, and we just sum them up and we have one functioning human being. But to a certain extent, we can still consider. So it's just an example that holding your arm up is also a control system, and it's a closed loop system. So if you set the goal that okay, I hold my hand upwards like that, and your brain, your eyes, if you are looking at your arm, will make the decision that okay, now it's in a good position, then your muscle tries to keep that position. And the position sensor, whether it's your eyes and your brain in general, senses that okay, it's in the right position. But if there's a wind or someone is pulling your arm or something, then the muscle needs to make more work in order to maintain the position that you decided to have. And at some point, if you hold your hand long enough, then your muscles get weak and you get more problems in order to maintain that position, and your hand may start shaking and so on, which makes there's some error and other inputs that affect. And in the end, if you try to hold it for hours, then at some point your muscles get so weak that you no longer can even if you would like to have the keep the position, you cannot do it. So the same goes with the car. This can work until you run out of gas, for example. Then one more is level control in a dam. So we set a certain level of water on the other side of the dam. Then we have sluice gates that open and close these gates, so that how much water can flow out. And then we have a level sensor that the level senses the level, whether at the required level or not. And if it's too high, then we open more the gates, and if it's too low, then we close the gates and wait until the water goes up again. Of course, if it's a dry season, and even if we close the gates and there is no water coming from the upstream, the level is always too low, then of course this thing cannot help. But that's another type of that. Then we would need to widen the system and see where the problem is, whether there is another dam upstream or whether there is some other things happening upstream that can affect it. But it's about the kind of the boundary, setting the boundaries of the system. Okay, let's go to the actual matter. So if we now think about control systems, in general, a generalized block diagram of basically any control system can be shown like this. So we have an input of some sort. It doesn't matter. We don't have to have this as voltage. It can be current. It can be temperature. It can be sound. It can be humidity. It can be anything. Then we have the input system that takes that signal in. It can convert it to something else. So it can convert the humidity into electronic signal already here and then go to the next stage. Or it can be so any mechanical system can be modeled like with this kind of block diagram as well. But anyway, now we are dealing with electronic systems. So we consider that there's a voltage signal coming in. It can be amplified a certain way, or there's something happening to that. Then we go to this comparator part, that we take the input signal, and then we compare the output of the main forward path through a feedback path, and all these TI, G, H, T0 or TO, they are all some sort of transfer functions. So they can be, we talked about these transfer functions in part A already. And so they do something for the signal. And so this is a general picture that can be used to model many things, almost anything. In many cases, this TI and TO are equal to one, so there's nothing happening, so the signal just goes through, and we only have the middle part, which is kind of the main thing that we will now consider. So this is the closed loop, the negative feedback. Then one thing that needs to be which is very important. So it's a key for this chapter and key for these block diagrams is the kind of the rules how to consider these signals. So if we have the block diagrams, they don't follow, they are not circuit diagrams the same way that we dealt with in part A when we had resistors and capacitors and so on. We have current flowing through, and so we don't use the Kirchhoff's laws for the block diagrams. This is one thing to be really sure. The block diagrams are basically used for describing graphically the equations. We will soon see how it works. So now if we consider the block diagrams and the symbols in the block diagram, so if we have this kind of thing that we have a signal U1 summed with U2, and then that is summed, or that there is U3 is subtracted from that summation, and that gives us Y output of Y1. Because of the rules for summation, it doesn't matter in which order we do it. We can then first subtract the U3 from U1 and then sum that product with U2, and we get the same. Or we can do everything in at once. So these are the kind of the basic rules. Same goes kind of the division. So we are now, remember that we are not dealing with Kirchhoff's law. So there's no, the current is not kind of dividing into three parts. So we can, U1 is now, the signal is now divided into three different places. So now this means that U1 is equal Y1, and it's equal to Y2, and it's equal to Y3. So they are all these three are equal, and they are equal to this Y1. And it doesn't matter how you kind of when do you take this branch, so you can take it in any order of here. So for basic blocks, so if you have a transfer function or transfer functions, G1, G2. So, because it's basically multiplication, so we multiply the input signal U with the transfer function G1, and then we multiply it with G2. Doesn't matter, we can do it like we multiply first these two transfer functions and then multiply that product with the input. So it works as well. Or if we have a parallel configuration that we process the input with two transfer functions and then we sum up these products from there, we might as well first sum these two transfer functions and then multiply that with the input U. So these are just works as well. And then a little bit more complicated if we have this loop. So we have an input U going in forward. Then there is a from the output we are taking back. So there's a feedback through G2, and we subtract that feedback signal from the input signal, and there's this kind of a loop that happens. It can be shown that the total transfer function of this system here is looks like this. So there's a forward path transfer function divided by 1 plus the forward path times the feedback path transfer functions. That is very easy to show. I think it will be shown in a minute. Then other rules. So if we have, for example, this kind of case that we first sum up two signals and then it goes through a transfer function G, we might as well process these two inputs with the G first, and then we sum up the outputs from that. And if we have now this kind of case that the U1 is going through a transfer function G first, and then we sum that with U2, then if you would like to move this G block on the other side of that summation, we need to divide this U2 with that G first in order to get this the right result. So these follow a basic arithmetic rules. So it's just a graphical way of doing summations and equations in general. And if we would have a kind of dividing the output to two different places, we can first divide it and then use the transfer function G to both of the branches individually. So these are just ways of manipulating the block diagrams. Sometimes it's easier to make these transformations and moving the summations one way or another in order to make it easier to analyze the block diagram. So you will see that in the exercises. So the feedback system. So now we will consider the kind of the center part of that this negative feedback system. So we have input Xi, we have the subtractor forward path which has the transfer function G, feedback path with the transfer function H, and the output XO is taken from the output of the G. So let's see how this thing works. So very simple. So if we consider now that what is the signal at this point? So before it goes to A, we can now just simply mark it as it's actually the output divided by A. And what is the output of the feedback path that is going into the subtractor, it's B times XO. Okay, now I forgot to mention that the forward path is now just simply the transfer function for it's given A, and the feedback path is given as B. So they are just whatever transfer function that we might have. So now we can simply write a simple equation for this. So what is this XO divided by A? It's XI minus B XO. And then we just rearrange this into an overall gain or overall transfer function, which is defined as XO over XI. And when we manipulate this or rearrange, we get the total transfer function for this system, which now we are giving as capital G, is A divided by 1 plus AB. So this is very important to remember now. So how this thing works. So we have a minus this negative feedback here. So we subtract the output of the system through some transfer function. This can be basically anything. It can be just one, or it can be some other type of transfer function. And it will, in the end, it will be the form is this. So we have the forward path A here. So if B is zero, so we don't have the, so that would mean that we don't take any back. So there's no feedback. Then this will go to zero, and the transfer function is simply A. We will soon see that the what how this thing works for in examples. So terminology, this A is now we call that as a open loop gain, and the G is overall or closed loop gain. And then a few words about this product AB, which is in the denominator. So if we have a negative AB, so if AB is negative and it's the kind of the absolute value is less than one, then we have a situation that the denominator is less than one. And it means that the overall transfer function of the closed loop gain is higher than the open loop gain, which means that we have a positive feedback. So we are feeding back kind of more effectively, and we are kind of making bigger and bigger. And if we have this AB is positive, this means that this 1 plus AB is higher than 1, which makes the overall gain G is less than A, which means that we have a negative feedback in this system. And moreover, if AB is positive and it's much greater than one, then what we have is that this overall closed loop gain becomes defined basically only by the feedback path. So now we know that if the AB is much greater than unity, then the forward path transfer function doesn't matter in the end. So we have an independence of that A. And this is actually what happens when the operational amplifier circuits. We will soon see how it works, but it's kind of just reminding you about those that we where we were where we where we were dealing with at the in the part A course. So it can be this negative feedback can be applied many ways. So like said, these XI and XO, they can be temperatures, pressure, whatever. And but now we are dealing with mostly voltages and currents. And the negative feedback is really important to overcoming the variability. So all active amplifiers and active devices, there are some level of variability, the gain and other characteristics that can vary with temperature and between devices. So as I mentioned in part A, so if we take an operational amplifier, some model of an operational amplifier, the gain of the operational amplifier can change by a factor of let's say five or maybe even more. But then, of course, if we want to make an amplifier that has a is having a amplification that is controlled. So you want to have a controlled amplification, then you of course would like to make the design so that if you need to change the operational amplifier, or you make many of them, many amplifiers, and you need to take a bunch of different devices, same model, same manufacturer, but still it can have variability in the amplification or the gain, then you wouldn't want to tune up for every amplifier that you make in order to have it control. So that's why this negative feedback is useful, that it kind of makes it insensitive to those variabilities. So in the previous example or previous treatment, you saw that when this product AB becomes much greater than one, then the forward path transfer function is no longer affecting the output that much. So that is the kind of the key to overcoming the variability in device parameters. And also it can be so that the temperature affects the gain or some other characteristics of the device. So if it gets hot, then if you don't use feedback, or if the design is bad, the gain chain, the operational amplifier, the gain might change, which may change the overall system amplification, which then might end up giving you problems. And if you design it properly, those you won't have those problems anymore. So here's an example. So that we would like to have a stable voltage gain of 100 using a high gain active amplifier. But the amplifier itself, the gain or the amplification can vary between 100,000 and 200,000. So if we now use the block diagram in this treatment, so that we have the active amplifier is our A, and the B is our feedback path, and the signal is coming into this loop, and then we take out from the A. So let's see how this thing works. So first of all, we make an assumption that we would like to have, when we want to have an overall gain of 100, and from the previous, that if the A times B is much greater than unity, then that G is approximately 1 over B. So now we assume that, okay, this AB is much greater than unity, which is fair assumption or estimate, because if you have 100,000 times 100, it's 10 million. So it's pretty okay to assume that it's much greater than 1. So G is 1 over B. So now this G is, well, B is becomes now 1 over 100, so 0.01. So if we now consider it like this, oh sorry, I messed it up. So 1 over B is G is 100, so 1 over B, yes, so B is 0.01. So AB is now 100,000 times it's about 1,000 or 2,000, so it's still much greater than 1, which is fair assumption. So now if you take that into this into the exact transfer function equation, so A divided by 1 plus AB, it gives us 99.90, which is fairly close to 1 over b that we assumed in the beginning, or we set in the beginning. So it's not exactly 100, but it's very close. So we could tune this up and make this be so that it is exactly 100, but it's not the point in this example, because the point is that now the operational amplifier, the active amplifier that we used, first we have 100,000 for the amplification, and then if we change that into 200,000, then and we have the same B, so we have fixed the B, the G changes only 0.5%. So now it's 99.95. So very close to 100. So even though our active amplifier, the gain was changed by a factor of 2, the total transfer function of our system didn't change that much, because it was basically set by this B value, which can be then defined by passive components that are in our own control. So we can external components that necessarily doesn't don't change that much. So of course it requires that B is stable, but fortunately we can make that B with the stable passive components. So how to do it is an example that we need to have an overall gain greater than 1, requires a feedback gain less than 1. So in this case, we had this 0.01 for B. So we can now consider that just from a, so these inputs and outputs are not the input of the system and input the output of the whole system, but it's for the feedback path, the input to the of the feedback path and the output of the feedback path. So now we can realize this feedback transfer function simply with this kind of setup. So it's just a simple potential divider. So we have R and 99 R, so it doesn't matter whether this is 1 kilo ohm and 99 kilo ohm or something like that. So now we have a factor of 0.01 from this input to this output. Okay, so we could do it like this. So we take from the we have this active amplifier A, and we take the output through this feedback path like this to a subtractor that subtracts the feedback signal from the input signal. And this would have a gain of 100, more or less. If this A would if it would put this A as infinite, then this system would have exactly 100 as a gain. If it would be less than you saw in the previous, that with 100,000, it gave 99.9, 200,000 gave 99.95. Okay, so the next question is that what is this subtractor here? How to realize and how to make that? Luckily, operational amplifier basically acts as a subtractor on its own. So you remember how the operational amplifier was defined, so that we put in the non-inverting input signal, and we subtract from that signal the non-invert the inverting signal, and multiply that with the internal gain. So with an operational amplifier, we can make that amplifier that we were asked for. and we assume that this A, the product AB was much greater than one, or A is much greater than one over B. This is the kind of the requirement that we need in order to this to work. So if this AB starts to be close to one, then this fails, so it doesn't work anymore. But luckily, the operational amplifier, the internal gains are usually much, much greater than one on its own. So they are 100,000, 1,000,000 or something. Okay, then a few words about the effects of feedback. We already discussed this in part A to a certain extent, so I will go through this rather quickly. So effects on the gain are already quite obvious. So if when we have the negative feedback, it gives us this overall gain. So the feedback reduces the gain by factor 1 plus AB. So we have this denominator 1 plus AB here that reduces the total gain of the forward path. So if A is the forward path, then with the feedback, we get less depending on how this AB product is. If it's positive, then it's always the total G is always less than A. Effects on frequency response, this was already discussed quite in length in part A. So as told already and mentioned many times, that there's always a limited frequency response and bandwidth in amplifiers and in all systems, electronic systems. So at some higher frequencies, there is always a cutoff frequency. But if we have, for example, in the picture below, that if the bandwidth of our forward path amplifier or the transfer function, whatever, is having a certain relatively narrow bandwidth but high gain, then with feedback, we can increase the bandwidth, but the gain of the closed loop system is going down. So basically, there's kind of an envelope curve that is set by the forward path transfer function that is limiting our bandwidth, but then we can get the bandwidth wider. It just means that in that frequency range, the gain is defined by the feedback path. Okay, I think we can. I will continue here from here on Wednesday and stop now. Is there any questions at this moment? If not, then we continue on Wednesday. Thank you.